and then competing for the design for the various components thereof. And so we've reached the end of the financial year, the design phase. As of today, we've reached the end of the specification phase of that implementing that. We will now, towards the end of the calendar year, move into the next financial year, as we move forward, proper career pathing, and then skills development. Obviously, as I'm sure you're aware, that there's always a risk in training up people and then losing people. I think what's becoming very clear to us is that, to some extent, with legislation, creating a bit of a market out there for compliance officers, for analysts, both in the private as well as the public sector. And we need to manage very carefully that we don't become the training and coaching ground. Yes, we'll lose people, but at the same time we need to try and retain them. Our physical location needs to be based on our developing needs. At the moment we are hogging the space in Treasury Inc. We'll be moving away from Treasury Inc. Over a period of time. We need to make sure that all the internal policies and things, procedures, practices, and then obviously this is a budget that's sustainable. We need to ensure that the information that comes from the centre to the enforcement authority is of high quality and has integrity. That's critical. The law enforcement authorities will simply not have if they do not believe there's integrity behind that information. So, that is a major concern and certainly a risk area that we have to manage continuously. We need to have the IT basis to receive analysis of the. We also need increased international cooperation, both in the region and more widely than that. We need to be able to request, refer, move information around and learn from other experiences. Along with that, part of this rollout process that starts is to firstly understand ourselves what it is that we are expected to do in terms of legislation. But at the same time getting our various stakeholders to understand that yes, we are able to perform certain functions, but there are also limits of what we can do and what we can't do. And that we have certain legal and other responsibilities in relation to the integrity of those processes. So there's a lot of ironing out of perception out there and the expectations that have been created. A lot of that is then linked to liaisons and ongoing feedback between ourselves and the various stakeholders, particularly government, and training and capacity building process. We need to focus continuously on the prevention aspect of things, and their awareness and training becomes critical. As we've said, we've focused quite a bit on the amendments to the legislation. We need to ensure that there's a continuous drive to enhance compliance in terms of the legislation. We need to monitor and supervise everybody, we need to monitor, we need to be conducting inspections, and we need to impose penalties where there have been transgressions. And that process is something that we need to drive on a continuous basis. And in conjunction with various society bodies. And finally, underpinning all of this change, we need to ensure that the legal system remains dynamic, it's robust, relevant. Therefore, the amendments to the Act, we need to make sure that the mutual evaluation process continues properly and we can feed the results of that into a review process. We need to understand the threats that we face as a country. Individual stakeholders and country as a whole, and we need to deal with those threats, and we need to make sure that we are working in conjunction with the developing and changing international standards. Chair, that's my report to summarize as I trust the written document before you. I trust you covered everything, and certainly I'm available to answer questions, and any member of my team will be in fact. I would even prefer being able to simply refer questions to them. Thank you very much.
I'm sure you're aware that there's a presentation of that. I'm saying that I think it's a good idea. I'm not a part of it.
concern here before we move forward, I would imagine the issue has been addressed in the earlier one. I'm simply asking myself the question here. What is it that I should ask? Or what is it that I should not ask? I'm trying to appreciate the nature of work that the team is involved in. To a point where we are certainly going to portray trying to dig into a number of issues. I will take some guidance before we proceed.
And the member of parliament cannot be limited in terms of what to ask, not to ask. Therefore, in terms of our rule, in the department of this nature, therefore, we have to request the threat to you to leave us and in committee so that members of the committee can ask as really as a member of parliament.
How does it operate? You are equally indicating your thoughts here that says, you know, you are very happy with the work that you're doing. Well, what is the relationship between the audit committee and yourself? We have a case in point here of the receiver of revenue, where he has an audit committee that reports directly to the committee. Which I find very, very difficult in this case. You could have voted in the school. In that slide, if you understand where I'm coming from. Second one, this is the last one, let's start it again. On your financial management report, in your I'm your response. You have part of your mother carrying on with your faith, like the stuff that you've everything accumulated over the past 8 years, or 3 when you started to mention. This financial year, you have now allocation from the department, from National Sister Fund. I'm just keen to understand the reason behind that now allocation, rather, that surplus. Whether would that have had anything to do with the staff that are not all fully occupied, or what could have been other reasons behind that, and also the meaning for your own faith of that now allocation. What does it mean also going forward? Are you still able to get back to the system? Or are you still continuing with your suffering that you started accumulating over a period of time? So those two for now.
Thank you.
Just like Scott said, saying that we can take this confidentiality and secrecy far. I can't possibly imagine that statistical analysis such as this could lead to any state secret being disclosed. And I think that it's important for people in Parliament not to have their first knee-jerk reaction, the idea that we were going to do it. We're supposed to be open. The public have also got a right to that. If they really are secret, operational matters, and if you want to know that Gibson has smuggled $10 million, well, okay, you're not entitled to tell the government that. But for the rest, we carry the experience and we suggest that it's all very serious. Having said that, I think the chair's ruling is entirely correct in the practice of what I'm saying. I'd like to ask a couple of questions. Firstly, we were told that later in the year there's going to be an amendment to the Act. Now, you also mentioned that we're going to do this mutual review thing, peer review thing, which I understand is taking place next year. Is there any possibility that the amendments we need now, and whatever the outcome of the review is, could require further amendments? And is the idea that we might perhaps have an amendment this year and another one next year, or is it going to be consolidated? That's the first thing. Secondly, the last time our friends appeared before us, I expressed some concern about the fact we seem to know nothing about what happens to the referral that goes to the investigating authority. We told that in excess of 1.4 billion rand and 549 referrals. I must say that I find it unbelievable that we're prepared simply to refer 549 cases and then not know what happens to any of them. And I believe that this is a big weakness which needs to be rectified. There needs to be proper reporting back to the FIC. Because if there isn't, you don't have them, they're just wasting their time. Are all these 549 just disappearing, sitting on some sort of investigation authority's desk? Or the police, perhaps, haven't got the resources or the sophistication to take this to a logical conclusion? Or we're not reporting properly, or not providing the investigating authorities that with the information that they would need in order to prosecute. So it's absolutely essential to the FRC to know how many prosecutions have resulted, how many acquittals have resulted, withdrawals of cases, and how many successful prosecutions. Because that, in the final release, is surely one of the measures of whether it's worthwhile having it or not. I'm well aware of the fact that the other measure is a more intangible one, and that is to have an atmosphere in the world, a country in which there's not money laundering, just allowed to go ahead, and where there is strict reporting. So I'm aware of that aspect of it. Talk is cheap, money buys the whiskey. How many prosecutions? Is this whole exercise worthwhile? So that's the second thing. it's an important commodity, that one. So, and then my final question. When we develop these proposals to amend the Act and publicize it, I wonder if we can seize the opportunity at that time to explain to the public, but more particularly to the financial institutions, exactly what the FRC does require and what is totally unnecessary. I don't want to be anecdotal, but I've had further experiences since we last met, and there's just an unnecessary level of compliance, bureaucracy, red tape, all of which creates costs for the authority which thinks it has to comply, and irritation and respect for ordinary citizens. So I just wonder if that can be better explained. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The one question that I wanted to ask has been asked by Mr. Gibson, and it wasn't fully there. But it's good for us to have figures of 1.4 billion, but we just want to know the effectiveness of how much that's been recovered and things like that. Secondly, Chair, just a question on stocking. I think Mr. Mitchell did indicate that you referred us to one of the slides on stock of 83. What is the ideal number of stocks that the centre would require? What's your vacancy rate and your stock turnover rate? And also you refer to skills, Chair. What is the availability of required skills? Do we have required skills amongst us now to fill these vacancies? And another question, Chair, is on the United States Commission, page 3. I mean, one of the missions is to look at fight against crime, money laundering, and terror financing. Now, I know we've been told that there's 549 referrals. And what I'd like to know is any of these referrals were with regard to terror financing? I don't think we want the details, but where did your investigation reveal that there was terror financing involved? And then the question on the infrastructure requirements. It is envisaged that the center would self-fund the infrastructure that you require, or are the negotiations with the Treasury in that regard? Those would be my questions for now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you. Just wondering on the slight note whether the thought we'll be having good children soon as the Mr. Gibson statement. But if I may get to the heart of the core question that I wanted to ask, that there's two sorts. The one is on the profiling within FIFA. Indeed, overall, when one looks at this and analyzes it, there seems to be a very much positive movement trend. In the slide 12, we use professional cabinet support in reflecting the demographic profile in the country, and that's very positive. But when one looks at the management equity profile, there appears to be no significant change at the top level. Now, while that may be there may be a need for that now, it would be interesting to see what kind of business plan there is to review this and take steps to address this in the same manner that the what I call the broader one, the professionals and admin one, has been addressed. Because what this seems to say to me is there's a serious may put it, bless professionals in our country according to the profile being put here. So one just wants clarification what steps have been taken in that direction, Chairperson. The other one, which is on Edward's kind of legal aspect, which refers to slide 26, is on the gambling. Now, simply because I've only been in a casino when they were launched, and don't sort of find myself there all the time at all. So it could be a lack of ignorance. But I was under the impression, you know, this was seen as one of the major, not major, but significant outlets for laundering. Now, I was under the impression that they were set limits that, you know, these machines, or whatever you've got, wouldn't give you that amount beyond a certain figure. And I don't imagine people just want to go there for, say, 10,000 rand at a time. They'd be wondering if they'd done a heist, be looking for a lot more. So while I don't want to know the ins and outs so I can pursue that criminal activity, I'm just interested in learning exactly how we monitor them because they do get reports, etc. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Chair. My first question is going to touch on what my colleagues have talked about, the volumes and the figures. If we look at the 21,000 wallet transactions that have been reported, and then if you mention that it's with a bit of a concern that only 12% come from casinos, car dealers, auditors, car dealers, and individuals. So my first suspicion is that that is relatively low. So somewhere along the line, there must be an assumption being made of how many don't get reports. In other words, how big is that, and what are we talking about there? Because if you look at the 549 referrals, that's only 2.5% of the suspicion transactions reported. So in other words, one month to determine, and you look also at the justification of the FIC. I mean, the principle is correct, and we all support that, the policies and the approach. But you want to justify and say that, you know, is this problem really that big? I mean, do we have to do it? And obviously, then we must look at the viability of the whole unit and to what extent can this unit stand on its own legs in the future. That's the first one. And Shepard, the second one is obviously what I want to understand better is this cooperation with other bodies and units. Customs, we know, is a major point where there's a lot of apparent fraud and deals coming through and drugs and whatever the case may be. What is your relationship with them? And them and SAPS, so I think the police service might have the special investigation units involved. So to what extent is there cooperation, or to what extent is it duplication taking place there? And then, Chairperson, my last question is just in terms of your equity profile, and you have said that, you know, in the future it will look different, and you're referring to yourself and self-management. Now, the one thing that you don't see there, that is disabled, there's a specific target and approach by government. No mention is in my idea, and obviously in terms of the target of 2%, we know that people with disabilities is just as efficient as anyone that is able-bodied. So it is really, if that is the case, that there's no disabled, it's not acceptable at all. And obviously something that the FIC would have to rectify in the future. Thank you, Chair.
Imagine, you know, the issue about suspicious transactions and the number of cases reported, if you look at that slide, you can actually see the slide that we discussed last time.
snake. You haven't changed a thing like that. So we had a discussion on that. I'm not saying how the people are different like this, but it may be useful because of all, perhaps at some point, the matter we can think of has such a condition. Some of the people to just educate the commission for the benefit of all. What is the suspicious? So suspicious subversion in terms of this act is not the suspicious subversion that it's not because you really it is a suspicious subversion. So it would be useful just to once again just explain that subversion.
Sure, thank you very much. There are a range of questions here, and we can answer them in different ways. I'll certainly try and deal with that, and I'm going to refer to two colleagues. But I wonder if we shouldn't start off with this first, with this last question, as a bit of a context that will help dealing with some of the operational issues, and it then also refers to the question that was coming up from honourable members of the and Singh, and get to essentially around the value of these processes, the referrals and so on, how to monitor them. I'm going to ask Advocate Smith if that's okay.
Can you talk about this FDR process? What is it? How does it define? How does it efficiently formulate?
What are the obligations? We can then flow from more operations from that. At the theoretical level, the suspicious transaction is not defined or circumscribed to any great detail in the legislation. It refers simply to transactions which an institution believes or suspects involves the process of crime, or which does not appear to have a lawful purpose or an applicable business purpose. So in terms of the experience of the institution and the way it deals with clients, the expectations of the institution, how its clients would interact with it, the transaction would become reportable if it doesn't make sense in the terms to the institution. Or obviously if the institution from the behavior of the client or the instructions of the client would suspect that the process of crime might be involved in the transaction. We are in the process at the moment of finalizing guidance to institutions to give more details to institutions to apply these tests or to apply the lines to particular situations. And what we would like to do in that process is also give institutions a bit of advice or guidance on indicators to look for that we find come up regularly in reports to us or by some experience from law enforcement agencies, etc. Things like an unwarranted concern with anonymity by the client, or a particular or a client that is particularly concerned with having a transaction carried out in a certain way which is not necessarily avoid costs or would incur risks which you wouldn't expect in the business for a business to incur, but because the client wants the transaction money to be used to certain geographic locations, for instance, etc. So there would be a number of indicators that we could provide to institutions. The important part for us, though, is that we our story lies on the fact that the institution actually forms a suspicion. So we can't tell an institution these are the transactions you must be reporting. The institution must still be genuinely suspicious when they report a transaction to us. So they must still apply their mind on the basis of the information provided to us, plus the facts of a particular case that they are confronted with, and form a suspicion so that they can report that to us. Otherwise, we are actually predetermining the information that we are getting. In a mechanical way, and there isn't that true underlying trigger for a report of a suspicion in that it has been formed in somebody's mind because they assess the circumstances.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
understanding this issue of the values, the numbers and the values of referral to law enforcement. These remain suspicious only because the reporting institution deems them to be suspicious. But they may not be. We have to ascertain whether there's any further need to do something about them. Which then leads us onto the question of, well then, why is there a few referrals? We can only refer once our analysts have applied their minds and have decided that clearly there is something substantive here, there's something that warrants further investigation. And then there'll be the process to refer. Now part of what we are struggling with is to determine what do we report to the committee? What do we report to the public? Do we simply report the number of SDRs that we make to the FIC? That's pretty meaningless, because those are only the number of suspicions that were sent through. So what? But then when we set that against the referrals, then there's a sense of, well, out of that accumulated number of suspicious transaction reports to the FIC, we begin to get a sense of, well, this number, even though it's only a tiny percentage, this number has some meaning. Again, how do we then give value to that? We started looking at the financial value of those referrals as a means to. But again, we're not sure that has any, coming back to our existing question, you know, the weight of it's an issue for us. And certainly one of the things that we're struggling with is to try and build into the reporting process some form of evaluation, cost-benefit type evaluation. And any suggestions would be useful in that regard. But the point that was being made about the need to understand the way in which the information has gone through the entire value chain and has ended up in a constitution or non-constitution, is a very important point. And yes, I think that all of us would agree totally. We need to understand this. And certainly part of what I was alluding to in our stakeholder relations, the need to develop the understanding amongst our various stakeholders, particularly on the law enforcement side, that feedback is a vital component of what the FIC is. We need the feedback to be able to better understand and analyze the reports that come through to us. But also, the institutions reporting to us need that feedback. Are they on the right track or not? If they're not, then what are they doing? But I don't think that is part of the culture of law enforcement, and I stand to be corrected, but that's not necessarily part of the culture at this point in time. So, while we would like to move in that direction, I suspect it's going to take a while. And that's why in one of the slides I was alluding to the fact that we as FIC need to ensure that our stakeholders understand what our function is, what our responsibilities are, and we need to understand what is possible, what is not possible. And then, the value of it. Now, it's clear that there's huge value, there's huge financial value. I mean, I think one of the points that was made when we did a first annual report, after our first year of functioning, I recall the asset forfeiture unit explaining that they had seized 159 million, I stand to be corrected, their share, but I think it's 159 million in the first 9 months of the FIC functioning as a direct result of information passed over by us to it. They were able to do that. Now that was already, if you recall, Parliament allocated us 74 million for the first 3 years of our functioning within the first 9 months. 159 million had been seized as a consequence of direct information and so on. So there's clearly value there, but how do we determine that and bring it all together and report on that is a challenge that we are struggling with at the moment. And we don't have any clear answers to that. But the principle is correct, and yes, we need to find a way of being able to do that. Chair, if
we're looking at the mutual evaluation process and amendments to the Act, again, I don't want to hog the microphone, maybe I could ask again to talk about the mutual evaluation process and the intended process to deal. Why are we amending the Act now? Because it relates directly to the mutual evaluation assessment plus future reviews and so on. Let's bring the two elements together.
The amendments that were proposed by the FRC that closely with the National Treasury on the enforcement of the FRC obligations through administrative processes was something that was already identified at the stage when the financial intelligence center bill was before Parliament, before the legislation was passed. It was an issue that received a lot of discussion and consideration at this point in the committee itself. And at that point, it was realized that we haven't fully dealt with that issue in the legislation as well before Parliament back then. The measures that were in the bill at that stage were not entirely, or the committee wasn't entirely happy with it, the provisions that were proposed at that stage. There were constitutional concerns, etc. So those were taken out of the bill, and a single section was placed in the bill, but almost as a placeholder to address the issue of supervision and the involvement of supervisory bodies of the Reserve Bank, Financial Services Board and others. What they have done in the meantime now is to expand on that and come to we've proposed to the National Treasury to come back to Parliament with amendments to the bill to cement the role of supervisors in relation to supervision of the obligations of banks and others under this legislation. And also to expand on the ability to supervise compliance. So that is basically an issue that was left hanging from the time when the legislation went through Parliament a couple of years ago. What has also happened more at that point was that in the international framework, the Financial Action Task Force reviewed the international standard that was applied then, and according to which the previous version or the current version of the Financial Intelligence Index was drafted and developed. There was a process that the Financial Action Task Force started off with around about 2002, so just after our legislation was passed, and which led to a significantly increased standard in some areas being adopted in 2006. So by that time, our legislation had fallen behind the international standard that was currently accepted. This will necessitate further amendments to our legislation, specifically in the area of customer identification, making better room in the legislation for application of a risk-based approach, for instance, to identification, asking additional questions in relation to certain types of science that isn't provided for in our legislation, now finding the absolute beneficial owner that sits behind a corporate line, for instance, and such as that. There are also issues that we've come across in the implementation of our legislation, where we've learned a few lessons of how things can be done better, and improvements that can be made through the legislation through practical experience, and those will also be taken up in the review process through the legislation. So what this announced is that in the short term there will be amendments proposed specifically on the issue of supervision and enforcement of the legislation, which is an issue left from the previous occasion when the Parliament considered the legislation. But following that, and to bring our legislation in line with the new standards and accommodate new legislation, there will be further amendments proposed to the legislation, probably in the financial year following this financial year. So it will not be in the next year. But there is a process already underway to review our legislation, conduct the necessary consultation discussion with the industry that will follow in the near term, to start developing the proposals that we will make to the Treasury to further enhance and improve the legislation that we are currently. So, in a sense, it is related to the effect of the mutual evaluation, but it's not directly for the purpose of obtaining a better score, for instance, in individual evaluation, is because the international standard which is related to the individual evaluation process has changed. That we also have to amend our legislation. The individual evaluation itself is simply a measurement of how that international standard is implemented. So obviously, the more we can do before the evaluation takes place in terms of adapting our legislative framework and also showing improved implementation of the legislative framework, the better for the evaluation purposes. But I think our objective isn't necessarily focused on the evaluation. We want to do these things because we understand it's best practice, because we understand it will benefit our system in the implementation, not just to have a compliance issue in the evaluation process.
Thank you very much. If I could refer back to Honourable Member Johnson's earlier questions at the onset of this around the function of the Audit Committee and to whom it is responsible. In its initial setting up, the Audit Committee reported to me. In other words, the end of the financial year was to me. And as we move forward, the Audit Committee will be reporting directly to the Minister of the Executive Authority. So that's the process that will unfold as we move forward. So your point is taken in that regard. May I ask Alice Boane to comment on the issue of the surplus, how does it arise, how does it be managed, and how do we then wind it down, or how is it being wound down? The point here comes back on the same question, and all funding for the FIC comes off national treasury budget, appropriated by Parliament. And that would certainly be the case with the IT development as well. Part of a discussion and planning process that has been ongoing since the inception. I think that Alice is alluding to the earlier point that I've made in terms of the flood. was allocated to the FIC. The assumption by Parliament, by Treasury, that FIC would, 1st of January, after the legislation being promulgated, would open its doors and there would be staff and facilities and IT and all that. Real world something sort of work like, but we have to understand what the business was, we have to understand the business processes, analyze all of that very, very closely, and then start building, literally building. Where do we find the staff? And I think we come back now to the questions raised around equity issues and staffing. The first staff that was reflected here were seconded to us from various government departments, Treasury, Asset Forfeiture Units, NPA, and so on. And that also then impacted on the representativity of the staff and so on. But we were entrusted with understanding what this stuff is all about, get it up and running, and then the understanding that there's a handover process and a gradual moving out. We're on contracts. I'm on a 5-year contract and I've gone more than halfway in that process. The other managers are on contracts which will be coming up soon, and I hope they're feeling nervous, Jim. This process has to be reviewed, and certainly the minister is very cognizant of the fact that there's got to be both proper representativity, but it's also got to meet the standard set in legislation. Again, coming back to one of the questions in relation to equity and the table and so on, and I would certainly ask Grace, my longer if she has any responses, but at this point in time, our numbers are still low. We fall below the legal requirement to report to the Department of Labour and meet those standards. But in the current financial year, we will be meeting those thresholds, and therefore all of the equity requirements have to be implemented fully. Partly while it's beginning to open up on these slides, because it reflects our planning and our movement going forward in relation to the fund of equity, how we begin to deal with those issues. And personally, and Grace, there's a brunt of this, the issue of the payable foremost amongst those. We have to do that. It's not a question of meeting a particular legal threshold. We have to do that as part of the principles, as far as I'm concerned. But that then raises another issue of where do these. That's true. Are you suggesting we swap? But where do we come from? Firstly, what skills do we need? What competencies and skills do we need? We've had to, in the hard way, try and work out what it is that's required to perform the task that the deficit Parliament has given the FIC. There is no blueprint. There was no blueprint when we started the process. We had to look at our equivalents internationally. What do they do? How do they work? How are they staffed? What skills are there and so on? And then translate it into the South African context. Where do we find those skills? Are there already trained people, or do we have to train those people? And that, again, is an ongoing process. Yes, many of the skills do exist, but at the same time, they don't exist in the form that's applicable to FIC work. So if you say that there's an analyst, yes, the intelligence agencies have analysts, but do those analysts have the skills to do the kind of, to analyze the kind of reports that come through to the FIC? They've certainly got to adjust the skills they have, they've got to tweak them. There certainly has to be a retraining process. You can turn around and say, well, the banks have financial analysts. Well, good, but that's not an analyst who's going to look at a suspicious transaction and determine whether there's a, you know, proceeds from drug-related activity taking place here. It's a different set of analysis altogether. So we've got to understand, firstly, the process, and then begin to understand what skills, and then from what is available, begin to bring it all together and weld it into something which is unique and particular to the FIC, and that's been part of the process going forward. Again, we have to be creative about that, because we need to bring in people from the outside, but we also need to create our own set of skills. So that's part of the reference made to internal training and to academy and so on. One of the things we are going to face, Chair, in a big way, that Mr. Malanga will face from the compliance and the infectious, compliance monitoring and infectious is compliance officers and compliance inspectors. We know from talking to industry that the drive for increased compliance across business by government is also creating a market for compliance officers, administrators. We know that as we bring in people and train them on the job within the FIC, we're also going to be open to our trained personnel being poached. And we can already begin to see that that's an issue. A question was raised earlier on, have we lost staff in relation to what vacancies and so on? And that really is where we've lost, and again, the numbers are very, very small. We're talking about 3 people here, 4 people maybe. But that, I can see, is where we're going to potentially lose them, because they're high-value individuals, they come in highly skilled, and they're very, very marketable. So we, our approach is, yes, we need them on board, we need to learn from them. At the same time, we're putting in place an academy. So let's try and bring in young charter accountants, young graduates from university, train them for the job, so to speak. Yes, there's always a place we're going to lose them, they'll simply use us as a stepping stone elsewhere, but at the same time, we're contributing to our own needs, and at the same time, it's a bigger pool. So, we've got a place to start. The same thing applies to the analysts sitting in the FIC. Honourable members, spoke about management. Management is probably easiest of all of the skills that we give. All of us are learning, I think, specialists, lawyers and so on, and having to learn management also on the job. But that's probably an easier task than the actual core professional skills we need within the FIC going forward. And a lot of attention, Grace has spent a lot of time and interaction with social institutions, professional associations, with industry, with government, trying to ascertain competencies, JDs, where these things need development, how we can develop, how best to retain staff, incorporating into our processes various career pathing possibilities, trying to keep people within the ambit as much as possible. I think I've covered those issues. The last thing then would be around certain compliance issues and casinos and thresholds that was asked of us. And here I've asked Mr. Malone to come in, seeing that he is the expert on gambling.
Basically, I don't do much work with our next in gambling, but I think it's gambling observation. We have, to answer the question specifically, looked at the casino industry with the fact that we are not casino surveillance specialists or specialists in active running of a casino. And accordingly, our interaction with the gambling board and the provincial gambling authorities have assisted us in getting a better understanding of how money moves. I think that's the issue. How does money move in a casino? And based on our understanding and interactions and international observations as well, yes, a lot of money flows through a casino. That is why casinos are always touted as key gates of production and a flow of money. Because by the very fact of their existence is to receive money without genuinely internationally purchasing all this to either money that your people that's coming from my institution. And without being searching or costing any fair coverage of my gambling institutions as members all will have. In South African context, our gambling institutions have proved to do very well. They have basically, put through lots of profit. In the question of the context of compliance, if they are thresholds under our legislation, which might be an issue, which is part of the problem, who knows? In the sense that we only require interim examination for 25,000 rand that is currently extended or in cash is extended. It is a 5,000 note as well, but I think that's very circumscribed. So the issue is where the money flows really is on the table, where a person can come, a high roller, they have all these various houses or enclosures in the casino where, depending on your state and how often you gamble, whether tax evasion money from another or the corner shop. position that has to be cleared, what is the therapy that can come to the UK for 10,000 rand, if you're willing to gamble, you then get the status of loyalty points, and you then get graded up into these enclosed areas where the real money flows. It's not so much the recreational brand that goes in there with 25-cent slots or 5-cent slots, so there's various denominations. But the issue is really on the very fashion change levels. We have noticed, just to be short, that some groups have a cash lending machine where you can actually physically stand and pump money into this machine that will give you a type of a credit value reading, and it has no limit, has no time expired, it doesn't require who you are, and you can walk into the casino with it in the pocket and exchange it to another terminal or whatever. You know, accessing for fund, payment for fund, whatever, that person can walk in the next day and play the same card. So for those issues of vulnerability, really fail to see that become a problem.
Thanks very much, Toby.
That comes back to the earlier point about what we may not disclose.
Could I ask Chris just to touch on the issue that Member Moreira raised about only 12% non-banking reporting, and what is that, what's the implication of that for rollout and further compliance monitoring?
The whole issue of reporting must be understood against the background of the Act. Mali has mentioned that we have suspicious reporting transactions. Facility. We also have the credit finance reporting. But there are other provisions in our legislation which are typically important, like the tax threshold. It's not operational here. Where internationally you would find reporting, you find that a lot of the reports come in on the tax threshold because it's a simple mechanical exercise. I exchange cash to you, you and a council institution, my cash value of exchange is over 10,000, the limit is 10,000, therefore I report it. That data, as I said, is not added, and that's a very critical tool in the context. And you'll find that all these dealers, like attorneys, car dealers, that is where internationally a lot of money moves. The cash card dealer sells the car, and the car is safe for 50,000, automatically internationally they will report that. In South Africa, we have to rely on the suspicious nature or the unusual nature. Now, many of that doesn't happen because for various car dealers, 50,000 cash transaction might be normal. So it's not out of the scope of the type of business, and it therefore might not be suspicious that you get a low report. I'm just trying to show you how the various reporting mechanisms weigh up against each other. But over and above that, yes, these institutions have under-reported. And it's also because we are finding that they are not really implementing these procedures. Particularly if I'm a user industry, like the state agency industry, a lot of hard work needs to be done in that environment. To educate as to the importance of the partnership perspective we would like them to bring to the table, because they deal with a lot of transactions, and many of them, particularly in the school property area, deal with multi-million rand transactions. And the primary nature of the high value of the property, the cash component of it, is a very high cash component. And where comes a suspicious transaction or a foreigner that comes, who knows where the person comes from. And all the permutations and indicators start to come together, coalesce into the sort of total formula that seems up to you, say, before. But unfortunately, we do not get to before. So, an issue of training and education. But also the fact that we do not have the full gamut of reporting is the cash threshold that would assist us in many of these industries.
For the funds that have been privileged. Honourable Member Singh raised a question on terror financing. Yes, we have received suspicious reports in relation to that, a small number. Yes, they remain suspicious only. And all such reports have been referred directly through to the appropriate law enforcement agencies. But again, it's beginning to touch on some of that grey area here where I don't want to deal with in detail of operations unless I'm pushed on the matter further. I would appreciate not having to go over there. But I'd also like to come back to that value chain slide that we showed earlier on about the process moving through from reports all the way through to referrals and stuff, because it is a complex one and it does touch on the system working as a whole. May I ask Ms. McChrystal to highlight and to take my initial comment a bit further. I think it will also help with some of these compliance issues that have been raised and deal with some of the value of the reporting and referral process.
Thank you.
is one looking towards, you know, getting the currency to itself, and also the free trade agreements, you know, free trade. What is that called to if I see the fact that we're concerned? And my this on the 40 meter press is what might be a bit excessive, and also the 7 that he used to have. On the point of summary, I think that he used to have this is the personal for the test of 40 meters. And that is now you've got the 7 in terms of cyber 2-4.
And you could respond to this together with the last question. Thank you.
person. With respect to the book that you've given here, the Financial Intelligence Annual Report, I wanted to ask you to check on a question there, if I may check.
Last one to get it, sorry.
Is that you, sir?
is on page 77. We have also introduced an employee assistance program to promote the emotional and mental health of employees. This was a substantial investment.
So our information is less in finance. So I wonder if you can get any from the finance first. Okay. So, but the other objective, the first objective is for them to get the space, the sustainable and capable of institution. Now then they're thinking of as they're putting moving from an office that it can discover that it was good to the children, that is by the side of the children. But if you have mobile area, I'm sure the night goes to another place. So my question was that, isn't that cumbersome? So we have to move from one place to the other, put up IT like in all the stuff. In that sort of place, it would be cumbersome. What do you say? I did 5 days, so many prices, that means there was a problem. I've seen the main monster of the 6,000, I'm sure that you have to leave. But I don't remember it.
Small question on page 45 for the income share, because we heard earlier that the income is totally derived from financial allocation. We know that there's interest received of 4 million odd, but there's this other income, with a small amount, 350,000. Do you levy a charge for services that you render to anybody?
I'm going to call on my colleagues to deal with some of these. Could we start off with the mutual evaluation process? The rest seems to relate to culture, staffing, and the finances of that. Mutual evaluation is a broader context. I'm going to ask again Smith to talk about the question of our first mutual evaluation, the second round coming up. What are the consequences of that report? And then link it also, if possible, to issues of regional integration and some of the challenges that the centre faces, South Africa faces in a regional context in dealing with money laundering matters. So I've got to deal with that.
Thank you. Thank you,
Chief.
Yes, South Africa has had a few years of evaluation by the Financial Action Task Force, which was when South Africa became a member of this organization. Part of the process of becoming a member is that you are a country's first place on type of an apprenticeship process for a year as an observer, and during that period the country's systems, legislation, authorities, etc. is evaluated against the standards that applies at that time by the Financial Action Task Force. And depending on the outcome of that evaluation, the organization will then decide whether to admit the country as schooling or not. This evaluation in South Africa's case took place in 2003. So it was almost at the same time when the Financial Intelligence Centre started functioning in an operational capacity, started receiving reports and organisations, financial institutions started identifying new clients in terms of the legislation and so forth. So the evaluation was done with the understanding that the whole system that is being evaluated at that stage was very new. And at that stage, the evaluation process didn't involve much of a focus on results. It was more based on having the necessary measures in place. The framework, etc. So the evaluation on the legislation as it was at that stage was fairly positive. One of the aspects that was missing at that point in time was legislation dealing with debt financing, which South Africa only brought in later this evaluation having taken place. So I think on the whole, the evaluation at that stage was relatively positive and was sufficiently positive for the Financial Action Task Force to accept South Africa as a member of the organization. And what we've seen in
subsequent evaluations that the Financial Action Task Force has carried out for other members of the organisation is that our evaluation at that stage measures up relatively well to what's been done with other members. The situation at the currently would be that the standards have changed, so the questions that will be asked in the new evaluation, if there's a slide I think of, the evaluations that we've done subsequent to South African evaluations, this is according to the new standards that's been applied by FATF now, and that will be applied to South African questions in upcoming evaluations. Now the countries that we can compare with in terms of similarity in legislation and infrastructure systems on that slide, probably Australia and Ireland, countries with a similar legal system, similar type of legislation and similar institutions in place. And the result against this new standard hasn't been as favourable for most countries as they have experienced in the past evaluations, and we're probably going to fall in the same sort of category. One of the main reasons for that is that there's a much more emphasis in the evaluation process on the results and the sort of things that Honourable Sigurdsson has referred to experience in their question. The numbers of prosecutions, the deliverables that one can measure that flow from the implementation of the system. And most countries haven't been adequately capturing that information in the first place or haven't paid sufficient attention to generating those results from the system. And we find in our preparation process that one of the areas is the difficulty lies there as well, especially on the capturing of the information. We hear a lot of information, we hear a lot of reports on prosecutions being instituted, money laundering charges being brought against persons we know from interaction, but we receive a lot of requests from the investigators for information in ongoing investigations. But within the totality of the system where a number of authorities have to cooperate to get to a result, there isn't a single place where the information is captured. We can easily find the statistics of the numbers of prosecutions, the numbers of convictions, and so forth. On the consequences of the evaluation, the evaluation report that is the result of all of this effort is a public document. The FATF will publish that document on its website. The report will also be handed to the International Monetary Fund and to the World Bank. Will take account of the results of the evaluation in their own processes to assess the financial stability risk in the country. And they will also report a summary of the detailed findings in their processes. And unless the country can convince all of these organizations not to publish a report, the report will be made public. What it does is it provides a reflection on the integrity of the financial system from a money laundering point of view, or the ability to combat money laundering in the financial system. So there are significant consequences to the outcomes of the evaluation, and there are sufficient drivers for us to want to achieve an acceptable result from this evaluation process, because it does inform decisions that are not taken elsewhere in the world in relation to the integrity of the South African financial system, trustworthiness of banks in South Africa to pass on business to international counterparts, and the level of reliance that can be placed on the information generated from the South African identification processes, reporting processes, and so forth. One of the issues that is measured as part of the evaluation process is how locally based institutions apply the same standards in foreign operations, foreign branches, and subsidiaries. And this comes to the issue of regional integration. We see a lot of expansion at this stage of the discovery of financial systems into countries in our region. And that is done on the basis of the expectation that they will be operating according to the same standards in those neighboring countries as they are subjected to here in South Africa. Unless a higher standard applies in that country. But the fact of the matter is that in most cases where they have the expansion,
there isn't an equivalent amount of legislation at the moment, or regulation in place at the moment. So if students have to rely basically on homegrown policies or policies and internal systems, it's being exported from the head office to their regional operations, which places them at a disadvantage when they compete with banks and other institutions in those countries. So the issue of regional integration, expansion of the adoption of similar policies, and also reducing the risk that our financial system will be infiltrated from outside of South Africa, where money can be placed into the South African financial system from any of our neighboring countries. All of those issues, I think, are matters that we do take into serious consideration, and why we do spend a lot of time and effort in assisting our neighboring countries to implement and develop similar policies and develop the necessary measures and the institutional capacity that they would need to deal with problems of money laundering and tracing the proceeds from through their own financial systems and through the integrated financial system that we are working towards in the whole sub-region.
Thank you very much. So many people, I'm just seeing another note I've made. It was a question of, what if there's no report? What then?
In the current state of our legislation, the failure to report is a criminal offence. The legislation makes a legal obligation to report when a suspicion arises, and the failure to do so would be a criminal offence. The threshold reporting to which Mr. Malone referred earlier would similarly be in terms of legal obligations, and the failure to report a transaction over a certain threshold would also be a criminal offence. Now, those thresholds haven't been fixed yet, and as Mr. Malone pointed out, those sections on threshold reporting are not in operation in our legislation at the moment. One of the exercises that we are busy with is to determine what would be appropriate threshold to advise the Minister of Finance to fix for these cash transactions or cross-border transactions that will be mechanically reported. And the threshold determines to a great extent also the volume of information we would receive. If we fix a fairly low threshold, it would mean a high number of transactions will be reported on. If we fix a very high threshold, a low number of transactions would be reported on, but we would miss critical information in the process. So there's a balance that we're busy with determining at the moment, which also goes hand in hand with the implementation of our IT development to have in place the necessary infrastructure to enable the reporting and also to enable the analysis of the information that we will be receiving. The additional amendments to the FRC Act, which we have proposed to the National Treasury and this will come to Parliament in due course, will add to this layer of criminal liability also the possibility for enforcement of these provisions through administrative sanctions, which would mean that the institutions that does not report, or an institution that doesn't have sufficient systems to pick up transactions to report, would be subjected to certain remedial action by a supervisor, would have to put in place certain measures, etc., directed by a supervisor to remedy shortcomings and to address those issues. So apart from a criminal liability, there would be more nuanced measures in place to deal with shortcomings or failure to comply with the obligation to report. What we're seeing at this stage is that if an institution doesn't report, and I think that's the one slide there to show, that there's a high likelihood that other institutions involved in a similar series of transactions would report. And we would, through the analysis work, also pick up that there's a missing link here. There's an institution where we can see money move to, but we don't have a report from that institution. So through the analysis work and the monitoring on the analysis that we carry out, for the information we receive, we're already starting to pick up black holes or dark spots where we can see that there's an expectation that we should have a report on a particular institution that we don't have the information from that institution. So that's starting to enhance our capacity to pick up instances where reporting should have taken place, but it didn't. And we are able to engage with the institutions or with the relevant supervisors from that period. And I think in a number of recent experiences, there's also a realization among law enforcement agencies that this is a legal
investigation with on institutions and where they find through their own investigation that the institution hasn't reported. There's been also a suspicion of complicity in money laundering scheme on that part of that institution. And there's more and more pressure coming from law enforcement agencies to actually charge institutions with failure to report to comply with their obligations. So there is a number of pressure points on the institutions to actually report what they are expected to do. I think the final point on this is that if an institution does not report, and if they sound that they're busy with the process of trying to do their transaction activity, they would expose themselves to money laundering charges. If an institution has reported, the fact of its report is that the defense for the institution for its involvement in with the funds that that it handles. So there is an added incentive to the institution to actually report when they find that something is suspicious, otherwise it would be exposing themselves to greater and greater criminal activity.
Is more for enhancing the existing skills in the FIT, mainly to assist them to deal with personal challenges
that they experience on a day-to-day. Employees have got an option to receive tax savings via telephone by calling the number allocated to the FRC, or they've got an option to receive tax savings on a face-to-face. The drug service is offered by the external service provider. We went that route because we wanted to ensure that the confidentiality is maintained so that all the employees are comfortable to talk about personal problems that they have. Coming back to the issue of the academy, there was a question whether, in fact, there are many academies in different government departments, and whether the training is conducted internally or is conducted outside. The response to that is that the training is a combination of internal training and external training. We have cooperated with some of the government departments to use their academy. We are working with staff, and we do send some of staff or interns to the sub academy to attend the training that is related to the FIC. Thank you.
I have to pay her. There's one outstanding issue, and that is the question of culture. Creating an FIC culture, and possibly there's one number of comments on that as well. Clearly, you can ask me again a year from now whether we've had it or not. But that's a very, very important question for us. As we develop as an organization, we have to develop firstly an identity and a set of rules by which we all work and which we feel we understand and are comfortable with as an organization. Now, our difficulty at this point in time is that we're not here with a long-established state department. It's not as though we are developing or transforming an existing government department. We're literally creating something from nothing. And therefore, we have to create those rules ourselves and ensure that we all live by what we are creating. And that is a very difficult issue because it comes back to the staffing issue and where do we source people. It's not just a question of sourcing the skills, but it's also sourcing the organizational culture that people come from. So, for example, we have to create an environment where somebody who was an analyst in a section of the bank is able to work with somebody who was a detective in fact. And they're working together. So they're working in a new environment, according to new objectives, with a new set of rules. And very often there's difficulty, there's tensions, individuals who want to do things differently, and we find that we're having to almost create the rules as we go to the benefit of the organization and the benefit of the state, government as a whole, as we go. We can't predetermine these things now and write it and say, right, well, in 2 or 3 years time, this is how we're going to be doing it. We've got to reflect on the process as we go. So part of the creating a culture, when we talk about creating a culture, it's to ensure that, and there's many different elements, to ensure that individuals are bound by what is essentially what will become the future FIC way of doing things. The code of ethics, for example, will be lived, will be understood and lived. We'll understand what financial disclosure means on a continuous basis. There's a question of employee wellness. There are serious pressures on people in the FIC. They're sitting with a huge amount of information which might pertain to any member sitting here at this point in time. that we have to sit opposite you and account, and that creates layers of stress and pressure and problems. You go home in the evening and you open up the media and you see a case that you know that you've been working on splashed across the media. How do you deal with it? How do you deal when you go to a party on a Saturday night and people start, yeah, you're doing this, you're doing that, and this is this, the politics of it, all the rest of it. The political people carry this weight. What do they do with that information? They can't talk to anybody. We are typically talking about it here. So wait, what do we do with it? Now, this program, and as I said, picking up the phone, you may not by law and by the contract and so on disclose any information to anybody. So any calls into your phone, you're certainly not going to talk to them about the information. But the pressure is there. And it provides a safety valve for individual staff members. Safety valve, and also, it's not just the pressure, but what if there's illness or there's divorce or all of those other issues as well, try and cover all of that. So that's all part of the culture of the organization, but also ensuring that we can attract people, that we can keep people, that we create opportunities for development within this process of building the institution. I just wanted to add that. I hope I've covered the issue. My understanding of the strat plan, Chair, is that bundled into Treasury's strat plan at this point in time, we've got to start extrapolating that and pulling that out. we prepare an independent strat plan, and certainly we're in the process of reviewing now for delivery end of September. But up until this point in time, it's been incorporated into what is effectively both 7. Yeah.
Maybe what the committee would have to look into is whether the strategic plan of infrastructure is sufficiently covered with operation for the industrial side. But I think it's an important question in evaluating now the appropriateness of your annual report for the report.
Should I comment on that as well? We've been entirely, and in fact our negotiations and discussions with the National Treasury is that we want to have an independent center. It helps us ensure that the full independence and separation of the FIC from Treasury takes place. So that's also important. An answer to the question of the location issues and the IT issues and the staffing issues. It's a gradual building and empowering, and now we've got a set of the court. So we're in the process of finalizing the review of our next 3-year staff plan, which will then come to independence of Treasury on the 30th of
September.
A follow-up question, you're saying, if I understood you correctly, you're saying the framework is underway to determine the threshold in relation to what would be the substantial transition. But on the same token, saying it is illegal for the institution not to report what they believe is a substantial transaction, and instead of saying that they may be losing, they may be risking being charged for money laundering. All said and done, presently, what would be the mechanism, and what would they say in our view, in our operational view, we don't see this as a sufficient transaction. What is at present now that is being used at present? Because I'm afraid the idea that we FIC is still relying on that goodwill part of it, that because they may be charged for money laundering, which is a criminal now offense, they will automatically report it.
Financial intelligence as the suggestion that they want to pull out the strat plan from federal strat plan, as well as now we receive the annual report. That's a clarification question. Now that suggests to me that they want to be on their own, have their own budget. And therefore, like any other, for instance, you speak about the government government, you speak about SARS, you speak about, what is the other one? they all can stand and come from the standard of one number and another for finance, level of supervision, or maybe to by level for English, but another supervision of Minister of Finance. This is a very interesting question I want to know.
Which in the circumstances in which it is placed was clearly sufficient
but the institution that didn't report, then that would amount to a failure. We could charge the institution for the failure to report. And those instances are coming up more and more in our experience, and we find more and more investigating officers doing cases to us where they find that the institutions that failed to report to them would be exposing themselves to the criminal prosecution. The additional steps that we can take to assist in the reporting of suspicious transactions would be through issuing guidance which would inform institutions on how to assess the set of circumstances and how to come to a conclusion that the transaction is suspicious. So we would be able to help institutions to take a decision whether a particular transaction is suspicious or not. But I think I just want to clarify that the threshold that applies to suspicious transactions, the suspicious transaction reporting would always be there where institutions come across a transaction that doesn't make sense, doesn't have a business purpose, or where the institution for some other reason becomes suspicious of the activity of the client. And that is detected from the threshold, which would be automatic reporting. And all of these would be subject to legal obligations. And I think that in the end, the Honourable Member is correct, so much of this would depend on the ability to enforce these provisions, which is a process which is improving at the moment. In the past, we've been almost in a position where we couldn't detect failure to support him, but that is changing at the moment. We do see more and more cases arising where we can pick up this and the institution actually fails to delay reports with the FIC. Future developments in terms of technology is things that we are exploring, extracting information without necessarily relying on the institution to report. But that is still very far off in the future, where we could provide institutions with technological tools to identify transactions which they can automatically pass on to the people.
Are you asking if we come back every 4 weeks?
I wasn't back. Thank you very much. That brings us to the end of the session. The committee meets on Friday. There is a slight change in the program because of some urgent matters and some of the matters have been communicated in that agent. Committee deals with the special adjustment appropriation bill. We will be taking a briefing from the Treasury. There are a number of state-owned enterprises that actually require the attention of this committee in order for us to continue. We will be circulating the appropriate documentation as a question of the budget of Friday and the venue is at 9 o'clock. So the members should go to the public at the end. Thank you very much, committee members. Thanks, FIC. Good luck.